This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton seeks another term in the U.S. House. But first, if you wonder what LZ Granderson thinks about a number of topics, there are plenty of opportunities to find out these days. He's a contributor to CNN and senior writer for ESPN. The Western Michigan University graduate will be back on campus Wednesday for an event sponsored by the School of Communication. Granderson's guest lecture is titled, We Are All Ferguson, How Not Being at the Table Puts You at Risk of Being on the Menu. LZ Granderson, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
So let's talk about what it means to be at the table. What are you talking about there?
It literally means that you have to be present, that your voice has to be present, that your interests have to be present. And you know, as it suggested in my talk title, I'm really looking at participating, you know, in your community, both politically, but then also as a volunteer and just as an observant. You know, it's really difficult to hold people accountable if you're not paying attention to what people are doing. And, you know, I have so much interaction with voters, you know, with my work through CNN, and I'm absolutely astounded at the rate in which people are able to regurgitate stuff that they hear, but they aren't able to actually explain what they've said. So being at the table, you know, it involves registering to vote, but it also involves being cognizant of what you're voting for and who's voted for what and whether or not those individuals represent your interest.
But you did write back in August after going down to Ferguson and visiting there, you noted that the power structure must change. I'm reading from what you wrote for CNN.com. When you know that just 6% of eligible black voters made it to the polls in the last municipal election in a city that is nearly 70% black, where to start that change is clear. Voting is an important part of the process then, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I spent a lot of time down there over the past 2 months, and particularly talking to younger people. You know, for older African-Americans in Ferguson or just African-Americans in general, there still is this sense of moral obligation to participate in elections because we're so close still to, you know, the civil rights movement. But as you start looking at millennials and they start observing the world differently, they don't have that same level of moral obligation, especially if their parents or their mentors or whomever happened to be around them doesn't stress the history and the significance of that history. And so you start asking yourself, well, if black millennials don't have this history and this moral obligation to push them to the polls, then what is pushing them to the polls? And when I was in Ferguson, I found out nothing actually was pushing them to the polls, which is why only 6 to 7% of them voted in the last municipal election, blacks in general, but then particularly, you know, you're looking at the millennials. And so we do have to focus in on voting and making sure that whether it's because of the history or whether because you want to see present day change, recognizing that protest is certainly one way to rally the troops. But once you've rallied the troops, what are you directing them to do? And it's my experience that getting them to pull together their economic resources and pull together their voting power is how you get really start to develop significant change. And I tell you, I look at the LGBT community, which you may remember 10 to 15 years ago was facing the prospects of never having the ability to get married. And not only that, but, you know, during the George W. Bush administration, conversations of having an amendment permanently banning same-sex marriages. And what have you seen over the last 10 to 15 years? You've seen a rallying of resources. You've seen openly LGBT candidates and elected officials, both locally as well as on the federal level, be more present and pushing for their voices to be heard at the table. And what do we have today? You can think of marriages now in Alaska that was almost unheard of, you know, 10 to 15 years ago. That's what rallying the troops mean. That's what getting to the polls can do for you.
But in reading your piece for CNN, many of the young people who you talk to, some of whom do vote, say that their friends just don't think it's going to change anything. How do you make the connection for people that, yes, registering, getting involved, being informed, as you mentioned, and then casting a vote is an important part of trying to bring about the change you want to see?
I think part of the reason why, particularly, you know, dealing with Ferguson, that people don't think anything's going to change is because they don't see anyone who reflects their interest. And when you peel back the numbers in terms of the voting that happened down there, 54% of blacks voted in the 2012 election. You know, and you can, you know, disseminate looking at the numbers that it's a highly Democratic county. So you can assume that 54%, a large majority of them, voted for President Obama. Now, you can make the argument that they voted for him simply because they're black, or they voted for him because of his policies. You know, that's something you have to ask every individual voter. But what is clear is that there was a connection with a particular candidate and motivated 54% of registered blacks to vote in Ferguson. And that same connection was not there locally, which reflected in the 6-7% of blacks that voted in the local election. In order to get people to think that their vote's going to matter, you have to have candidates available who represent their voice so that when they do cast their ballot, they feel as if their voices will be heard at that table. And so the next step for Ferguson, in my opinion, is not that you're starting to get people registering to vote. You have to start identifying candidates that people will want to vote for, who have policies that reflect interests of their own, so they can feel more invested in the process and not feel disconnected from the process.
Do you think the situation in Ferguson and the aftermath has led to any greater dialogue about race in this country, about tactics used by police, any of those things?
I think Ferguson has really highlighted a multitude of things. Yes, it certainly has continued on the conversation of race in this country. I actually just moderated a panel discussion last night with members of the media for Chicago Ideas Week, and we talked about the impact of Ferguson and as well as the election of President Obama and how that seems to have ushered in an era in which white America and blacks and Latinos are becoming a little bit more freer to talk about some of these uncomfortable conversations that we weren't having in the early 2000s, with the exception of the disaster in response to Katrina. What has been interesting, too, is the militarization of the police has become more of a present issue, something that the libertarians had always talked about, but we didn't really pay attention because we didn't have the visual to go along with what they were arguing for. But now we've seen these visuals, right? We've seen police officers in urban districts dressed in fatigues as if they were in the jungle. We've seen tanks on our streets. We've seen, you know, this use of tear gas and all these other militarized items or weapons, if you will, that really were made for much more hostile territories. You're sort of roaming the streets with everyday citizens. And so I think those visuals have also kind of rallied the troops and have forced, you know, everyone from the administration on down to really talk about whether or not the plans that were in place after 9/11 to help make sure that cities were able to deal with a terrorist threat. Have we gone too far? You know, the rules that are in place that require police departments to use this material, because if they don't, it can be taken from them. Is that a rule that needs to be reevaluated or denounced altogether? So Ferguson has not only helped facilitate the continual conversation about race relations in this country, but the militarization of the police has also come to the fore, and in my estimate, it's every bit as important as the race conversation.
Has that issue of the militarization of police created some openings for dialogue between groups who might normally have had a lot of opportunities to talk? I'm thinking libertarians in the African-American community. It's not two groups that we think of getting together a whole lot, but is this an issue where there is some common ground and perhaps a chance for greater exploration?
I think that, you know, Senator Rand Paul, for instance, has been fantastic in my estimation in terms of taking this opportunity as one to, you know, elevate himself in the minority community, which is a smart thing to do if he has 2016 aspirations, which I think we all can assume he does, but then also driving home issues that he recognizes does cross across gender and socioeconomics and race, and use it as a rallying point to really bring us together. And again, you know, some of those images that we saw and the way that the police handled not just the citizens but the media itself, I think we are being forced to have this conversation across all those different sort of groups, if you will, because it's something that ultimately impacts all of us. I mean, tanks are in cities or in small towns that are predominantly white, just like they're in larger cities that are predominantly black. So that's something we all can get behind and ask ourselves, do we really need this?
As I noted, you are a senior writer for ESPN, and you've covered sports for many years. The NFL has found itself dealing with a lot of off-the-field problems, which has created, of course, an image problem for the league, Ray Rice, Adrian Peterson. But you've kind of focused a little more on what's happened in the judicial system, especially with Ray Rice. What do these stories tell us about how people with celebrity status get treated in the legal system?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that, you know, the question is phrased that, you know, the NFL is now having these issues. The fact is that NFL has been having these domestic violence issues for decades. And whether it was, you know, Commissioner Goodell or Paul Tagliabue before him, there certainly has been a lackadaisical attitude in terms of really addressing this sort of trend of athletes not being punished by the teams for being involved with domestic violence issues. But then you have to take it a step further, right? So before you even ask how come the NFL or the individual teams have not sufficiently punished these men who have been convicted or arrested for domestic violence, but what happened through the judicial system that allowed them to not even serve any time in prison? And, you know, everyone is circling the wagons around the Ray Rice video and whether or not Roger Goodell saw it and if that should have impacted how much punishment he had. And I was still stuck on the fact that whether or not the NFL saw the video is not even that important to me. I'm wondering how did a judge in a prosecution office saw the video and didn't think that Ray Rice should have gone to jail? I'm trying to figure out how come he was given the most lightest possible sentence. We certainly should be looking at the judicial system. And also wrote about Judge Mark Fuller in Alabama, who also was arrested this summer for domestic violence. Police were called to a hotel in Atlanta. When they arrived, the judge's wife was bloodied. There was hair and blood and alcohol and broken glass in their hotel room. He was taken away. And like Ray Rice, is given pretty much a slap on the wrist and is actually still eligible to serve on the bench as a federal judge. So this isn't just an NFL problem. There still seems to be an overall problem with people who are perceived to either be celebrities or having some sort of great influence being treated very lightly, in my estimation, with regards to their involvement with domestic violence. And what a horrific message that sends, not only to women in this country, but to the men as well, letting them know that even if you do, you know, get angry and hit your wife, you may not necessarily feel the full brunt of the law. I think that's a horrible precedent that's been set. And, you know, again, we can talk about the NFL, but this is a much, much larger issue with our judicial system and the way that it handles domestic violence cases of people of note.
Does it also show that we're still not, for all of the supposed awareness of the issue, still not taking domestic violence as seriously as we need to?
Well, absolutely. I mean, think about the fact that, you know, that video with Solange and Jay-Z and Beyonce, you know, leaked on TMZ, and how it really just responded a bunch of laughter and jokes and not really an in-depth conversation about, you know, domestic violence. If you go on Facebook, you will see scores of videos of people being recording incidents of domestic violence, men and women hitting each other, and it's for entertainment purposes without any sort of, you know, emotional reaction to respond to the fact that this is actually domestic violence being videotaped, which means no one around is even bothering stopping the fighting from happening. In fact, it's being celebrated as something entertaining. And this has been a problem of ours in our culture for a decade. And perhaps the NFL high-profile struggles right now will help us start shifting away from that. But I doubt it. I doubt that one particular incident is able to correct decades and decades of cultural behavior. It's going to be a consistent beating of that particular drum, not to, you know, mix metaphors with beating and domestic violence, but it's going to take a consistent voice saying this is wrong and not just one blip, because if it's just one blip, it's very easy for us to dismiss it and move on.
Elsie Granderson, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Elsie Granderson is a contributor to CNN, senior writer for ESPN, and a Western Michigan University graduate who will be back on campus Wednesday for an event sponsored by the School of Communication. A link with more information can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton has been serving some part of Southwest Michigan since he was first elected to the House in 1986. The Republican representative is now chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. He's seeking his 15th term in the House. Fred Upton, thank you very much for being here.
Good to be here with you, Gordon. Thank you.
Briefly tell us and the audience what you would like to do with another 2 years in the House if you were to get them.
Well, there's a lot of things. I don't know that I can be brief, but I'll try to be very brief. I'm excited about this election November 4th, and I'm excited with what most of the pundits say is going to happen and then the agenda for next year. There's no question that all of us are really frustrated with the dysfunction that's been there, the partisan wrangling. I've never been part of that, but it's been nasty. And if you listen to any of the commentators, there's a pretty good sense that, in fact, Republicans will pick up maybe as much as a dozen seats, maybe a little bit more, a little bit less, but it's going to be pretty close to that. In the Senate, again, most observers think that the Senate's going to flip. And from the House perspective, that has really been the problem child, I guess you could say. In the House, we passed 384 bills or more that the Senate hasn't taken up. And you know, as we look to next year, if in fact the Republicans do control both houses, we have got to have a very positive agenda. And certainly that's been my philosophy ever since I got to the Congress, of working with both sides to get things done.
I should note that we are speaking on Friday, the day after the House subcommittee hearing on Ebola, which you were a big part of. You, in that hearing, said that there should be a travel ban on anybody coming from West Africa to the United States. The counterargument is that there is a danger in sort of driving it underground, that people are less willing to reveal that they perhaps have symptoms, or they go through a couple different stops and try to hide their travel itinerary before getting to the United States.
Well, the travel ban means that those people from West Africa are not going to be approved for a visa coming to this country. 150 a day, 1,000 a week, just about. The administration admits that there's not 100% screening for all those folks that are coming here. And last time I traveled overseas, I have a U.S. passport. And as I'm in that passport line going through Dulles or whatever entry point it is, Chicago, there's lines for U.S. citizens and for folks that hold a passport from other countries. And whether it's Liberia or Germany or France or whatever, there is a document indicating where that individual is from. Generally, even when you go to Canada, they stamp your passport and say that you've been here. It's pretty easy for a customs officer to determine where you've been. And I think we, like other countries have done, not only in that region, but even Jamaica has said, for the time being, until the issue is resolved over there, we're not going to allow visa entries for non-U.S. citizens into the United States. Yes, we have to fight this. Yes, it is a worldwide issue. And the predictions from our own administration is that there could be perhaps as a million people in that region impacted by this awful disease by early next year. We know that the death rate is about 70%. And we know that there's no vaccine, there's no cure, they're working around the clock. FDA confirmed yesterday that they're doing very fast approvals on virtually anything that's thrown their way to try and get the job done. But you know what? It's not done. And in the meantime, we know that we have only four facilities in this country that are capable of treating folks with Ebola. Maybe a dozen beds altogether, when you count those four together. And this system with Mr. Duncan, who died tragically, bad protocols, he lied, lots of mishaps. But, you know, Dallas is talking about a disaster declaration for Dallas County. The hospital there, they're not getting people to show up for work. And we cannot afford to have this escalate. And if you want to really be concerned about the health of the American people in the short term, we should just do what a number of other countries have said and say, no, we're not going to approve any visas here. It takes 21 days for someone to fully show the symptoms of this awful disease. So you easily could have somebody at day 12 or 14 who comes, has no exhibits, no temperature, allowed to come in. Yes, they give them a sheet. Okay, if you get these symptoms, please call us. Please go to the center. Well, where did they go in between? How many people might have they impacted by then? I mean, all of a sudden you have this trail, and it could be quite alarming. So I'm convinced, and based on yesterday, on this week's hearing yesterday as we tape this, that there is strong support to stop visa entry from those three countries into the U.S. There's some chatter, some talk about even the House. I think there's been a bill now introduced. I think it would pass in the House on a bipartisan basis, maybe as much as 3 or 4 to 1.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans, speaking with West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton, who is seeking his 15th term in the U.S. House. He is also the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. Let's go to healthcare for a moment. You have consistently said that you wanted to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. You have said pretty consistently that you do like some things, including the provision that says insurance companies cannot deny coverage for a pre-existing condition.
Right.
How do you do both of those? How do you say to insurance companies you can't deny coverage and yet not have something like a mandate or a single payer system in order to keep people from sort of going around the system?
A number of states have initiated what we call high-risk pools. So it was, if you look back at the whole healthcare issue, I mean, Ezekiel Emanuel is quoted in the New York Times saying that their goal was to eliminate private employer-based insurance by 2020, and they are well on the road to do that. Now, I have always stood for healthcare reform. There were a number of things that were broken, needed to be fixed. Among them, the ability of insurance companies, which I feel is wrong, to discriminate against those with a pre-existing illness. You can fix that by encouraging states to have what we call high-risk pools so that folks who are trying to get insurance, maybe they have, you know, name the disease, you can have those high-risk pools that the states help subsidize, and so does the federal government. And that is a far cheaper way than just to abandon the whole private sector, employer-based health insurance, which is being dismantled limb by limb. Last week, Walmart announced that they were going to cancel insurance for 30,000 Walmart employees. We tried to change the number of hours, 30 versus 40, and we actually passed that in the House earlier this year. Can't get the Senate to do it. What happened with the health insurance plan with Obamacare, as he calls it himself, you ended up with a very partisan bill. Not a single Republican, House or Senate, voted for it. A number of Democrats voted against it as well. That's not how we ought to be doing business in Washington. It ought to be bipartisan, particularly when it's something as important as health care. You could have done pre-existing conditions. You could have done certainly students, children under 25 or 26 years old. You could have allowed more competition in the workplace by allowing people to shop across state lines like you can for other insurance, auto and car. Tort reform, big reason why costs are going up. Even the president supported tort reform, yet we weren't able to get that amendment. Remember, when this bill came to the House floor, Speaker Pelosi allowed not a single Republican amendment on the floor. So you ended up with a partisan bill. That's not how we ought to do it, and that's not the way that Speaker Boehner has undertaken his speakership.
What would be the aspects of an immigration bill that you would want to see in order to get your vote?
Well, I support immigration reform. I've been on record on this for some time. I was deeply disappointed that we weren't able to do it through the House this year. That's one of the shining stars that the Senate gets, although there was a comprehensive single bill, 1,000-some pages, versus what I think would be a number of bills that accomplish much of the same, but border security is part of that. We do have to have a way for the folks that are undocumented here, a pathway to legal status is what I call it. We want to make sure that they've got no felony convictions, that their back taxes are paid, maybe a small administrative fine. We want to know where they are, what are they doing. if they want to become a citizen, this is not amnesty. They go to the end of the line. They learn English, civics, all the things that doesn't change. And we know traditionally only about 40% of the folks that are here without documentation want to become citizens. That number probably stays about the same. But, you know, I want people, you know, when I'm driving on the road, I want someone to come in the other way to have a driver's license, to have insurance. I commend our local law enforcement folks, Sheriff Fuller and the police chief here in Kalamazoo. I met with, I don't know, 400 or 500 people perhaps a year or two ago with the Hispanic Center here in Kalamazoo. And they both spoke and they said, you know what, we just want you to know, we know that many of you here are undocumented, we just know that. We want you to know that when a crime is committed on maybe your person or your home where you are, that we want you to report that crime to us because we want to catch that individual. We want to prosecute them, and we want to make sure that they serve a sentence if they're convicted. And we are not going to ask you your legal status if you report that crime, because if pick the crime, armed robbery, whatever it is, they'll probably continue to do it until they get caught. Well, we need people to come forward and say it was this person that did that. So I commend them, the local law enforcement, for what they do. But we also know that many of these folks, we have to deal with what's called the dreamers. You know, we actually had a case that we dealt with a young woman who came to this country, she was rescued from the sex trafficking in China. China has a policy, actually, they don't allow anybody out. If you get out of there, they don't allow you to come back. So thank goodness she was rescued. She was adopted, in essence, by a West Michigan family, but not formally adopted. She graduated, I want to say, with honors from Western, and she started looking for a job, and she found out she didn't know she wasn't an American citizen. Well, she's been here, 12, 14 years. You're not going to send her back. we need to figure this out. And that's why we're a better country than that. And that's why we have to figure out how to deal with the folks that are here illegally, without papers, figure out, and, estimates are as many as 11 million. I'm not for sending them all home to figure this out. I mean, let's send the word out now. Let's figure out a way that they can have some access to not... being in real trouble. Not that they aren't already.
A couple minutes left. Let's deal with politics. You are coming off an election 2 years ago where you were held to your lowest percentage total since you've been running, and there's a super PAC pumping a lot of money into this race. Is there reason to believe that this race could be maybe the most competitive you've ever been in?
Well, a couple things, Gordon. With every election, you get butterflies, okay? When you don't, then maybe you shouldn't be running. So there's really two ways to run. You either run unopposed or full speed ahead. 2 years ago, we had a little drag on our ticket called Mitt Romney, all right? Mitt Romney won our district narrowly. I won. I have always run ahead of our state and national ticket, as I did in 2012. I won by double digits. We had a good competitor then, Mike O'Brien, veteran, no scourge of the earth. I mean, he was a decent guy, a nice family. Anyway, fast forward to 2014. We have a different guy at the top of the ticket. His name's Rick Snyder, all right? Rick Snyder is going to win our district by more than 1 point. I think he's going to win maybe by 6 or 8 points. He's going to win the state. He's going to win re-election, too, for all the right reasons. I'm running ahead of Governor Snyder. We don't have any qualms about that. We have a good campaign that's out there. No, we didn't expect to see $1.5 million super PAC come in the last 2 weeks against us. They're spending a ton of money. It's all negative. This is why people get upset about negative campaigns, because, it is. They are negative. Our message is positive. We're talking about 21st century cures, all the good things that I'm doing. I've been bipartisan from day one in the Congress. When I was elected in the Congress, for my lifetime, Republicans were never in the majority. And I said, if I want to get something done, I got to work with the D's. And I did.
Fred Upton, thank you for your time.
You bet.
West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton has been representing part of Southwest Michigan since he was first elected in 1986. He's now seeking his 15th term in the House. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.